Well, it's good to have my oldest brother visiting with us over the weekend. And I would encourage all of you to meet him and get to know him. Just do not ask him whether any of the stories I tell of our childhood are true. He's getting old and his mind is not what it used to be. And if I need to convince you any further not to listen to anything he says, one thing I can remember, when we were kids, he ran, I think it was a rabbit through the blender. And that was for a science project, so it wasn't, you know, animal cruelty or something like that. He was dead first. But we certainly never use that blender again for eating anything. But actually, I mentioned that story because it has some bearing on what we'll be talking about today. We're continuing our study in the book of Hebrews. You want to be turning to Hebrews chapter 9. Because one of the main arguments that the Hebrew writer is going to make is, what is it about animals or the blood of animals that can really do anything for us? And the answer to that question is, well, they are good to eat. You can put them to work as living animals. Maybe you can conduct scientific experiments on them in the case of that example I gave. But in terms of eternal value, what is the blood of a bull or a goat able to accomplish? In other words, in the context of the old covenant sacrificial system where they would make various animal sacrifices and that was supposed to atone for the sins of man, could that really do the job? And the Hebrew writer, of course, says no. And a section we're not going to be looking at today, chapter 10, begins by a direct denial of that very thing. And the passage I had Zach read for us from chapter 10, verses 19 through 25, is really, in a lot of ways, the conclusion of this whole argument that we have been looking at from chapter 5 all the way through this part of chapter 10. And it basically falls into two parts, if you'll recall, that Jesus is our perfect high priest, and that is really the occupation, the concern of chapters 5 through 7, and then the focus of chapters 8 through 10 is that Jesus has offered up a perfect sacrifice. And so that's the particular focus of this section. And chapter 9 kind of embodies the main argument that the writer is going to make about the sacrifice of Jesus. And he does so by contrasting it with the old system. And so let's notice the first 10 verses of chapter 9. And he turns our attention to the old covenant system and the sanctuary that existed, the tabernacle that had been built under the direction of Moses and so on. And he gives a good bit of detail here, but he doesn't want to dwell on it that much, as we'll see. So let's look beginning in chapter 9, verse 1. Now, even the first covenant had regulations of divine worship and the earthly sanctuary. For there was a tabernacle prepared, the outer one, in which were the lampstand and the table and the sacred bread, and this is called the holy place. And behind the second veil there was a tabernacle, which is called the Holy of Holies, having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna and Aaron's rod which budded and the tables of the covenant, and above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. But of these things we cannot now speak in detail. And he would have been writing to people who were pretty familiar with the imagery and what all the furnishings of the tabernacle would call for and so on. But you'll notice what he has basically drawn our attention to is that the tabernacle was made up of two compartments. There was the first compartment you came into called the holy place, and this had certain furnishings in it. And then there was the second compartment behind the veil, the curtain that separated these two sections. And this was the most holy place. And this was a little bit different than the first section, because into the first section, the priest would come and go and they would busy themselves taking care of the various duties that they had. In the second section, only the high priest could go in there. And he could only go in there on one day out of the year, the Day of Atonement, or Yom Kippur. And he would make a couple of trips in there on that day to make atonement for himself and then for the nation. And that's ultimately what the Hebrew writer is going to draw our attention to. He's going to use the imagery of the Day of Atonement to make his case. And he's described the fact, of course, that there in the most holy place is the Ark of the Covenant, which is the footstool of God, and the mercy seat, the lid of the Ark of the Covenant, which is the throne seat of God. And of course, this is understood as imagery, not that God literally sat upon this seat, but it signified the presence of God among his people in a special way. And so it's one of those good news, bad news kinds of things. The good news is God is with us. God is in the middle of our camp, inside of this tent, in a most holy place. The bad news is there are all kinds of barriers and walls separating you from God. And how do you get to such a God? How can you be in the presence of such a God? Well, you can't. Only your representative, the high priest, can go in there, and he can only do that one time each year. And so he says, we can't spend time talking about the details of all of that, pressing on to more important things. Now, when these things have been so prepared, the priests are continually entering the outer tabernacle, performing the divine worship. But into the second, only the high priest enters once a year, not without blood, which he offers for himself and then for the sins of the people committed in ignorance. Now, the Holy Spirit is signifying this, that the way into the holy place has not yet been disclosed while the outer tabernacle is still standing, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience, since they relate only to food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until a time of reformation or correction. Now, what the Hebrew writer is arguing is, as long as that tabernacle is standing, and he doesn't mean physically, he's saying as long as that tabernacle has validity, as long as it has some purpose or significance to it, the significance is that access to God is restricted. Even the priests can't go into the most holy place where the mercy seat is to be found. Only the high priest can do that, and only once each year. And then he is taking in blood. What kind of blood? Well, it's the blood of animals, as it turns out. And these offerings that the priest is making relate to external things like food and drink and various washings and so on. And so basically what the writer is trying to get us to think about is, in terms of location, you have a priesthood and a system and a sacrificial offering that is taking place on the earth as opposed to heaven, is the case he's going to make with Christ here in a moment. And in terms of the blood that is supposed to be effective and accomplish the very goal and purpose for which this whole system exists, is animal blood versus the blood of some human. And then finally, the time element is it's something that is temporary and passing away versus something that is eternal and permanent. And these are the contrasts that you're going to see popping up time and again, beginning in verse 11 and running through the end of the chapter. And so the first 10 verses are simply to set the stage for his argument. And the argument now really begins in earnest with verse 11. And what he's going to describe to us is the new superior system of sacrifice, the superior sacrifice of Christ. And why is it superior? Well, as we've already hinted at, it's going to be superior because it is accomplished in heaven itself, in the real presence of God. It is accomplished by means of his own blood, not that of an animal. And it is accomplished eternally, permanently, so that it need not be repeated over and over again. So notice how he develops this argument. Verses 11 through 14 really are his argument in a nutshell. But when Christ appeared as the high priest of the good things to come, he entered through the greater and more perfect tabernacle, one not made with hands, that is to say, not of this creation. It's not of this earth. He had referred to the other sanctuary in verse 1 as the earthly sanctuary. Now, that isn't a derogatory term in that it means it's evil or something wrong with it. It was just of this earth. That it was a material, physical tabernacle, tent. But Jesus has entered into the greater and more perfect tent. We saw this at the beginning of chapter 8. There is the true tabernacle. And the old tabernacle was just a shadow or a copy of the real tabernacle. And so Jesus has entered into the true tabernacle, the perfect tabernacle, heaven itself. And not through the blood of goats and calves, but through His own blood, He entered the holy place once for all, having obtained eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer, sprinkling those who have been defiled, sanctify for the cleansing of the flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God? And so you see all three of these elements right here in just this handful of verses. That Christ has accomplished, secured for us eternal redemption. Something that is permanent. He did so in heaven itself, and He did so not by taking the blood of an animal in, but of taking His own blood, so to speak. Now, you'll notice the Hebrew writer doesn't actually word it that way. There are actually some translations, like the Revised Standard Version, that word it that way, but it seems as if the Hebrew writer actually goes out of his way to avoid saying that very thing. Because in the imagery of what's happening on the Day of Atonement, the high priest has to go and make this sacrifice. And the blood is drawn from the animal. And he has to carry that blood into the tabernacle. And there are certain things he's supposed to do with it. He's supposed to apply it to the horns of the altar of incense, even. And he's then supposed to sprinkle this blood on the top of the Ark of the Covenant, on the mercy seat. And he has to atone for his sin, and he has to atone for the sins of the nation through these two different sacrifices. And so here's this priest. You picture this priest. He's got to carry this bowl of blood with him into the very presence of God. Well, Jesus isn't carrying a bowl of blood. All Jesus has to do is enter the presence of God in His resurrected body. Because as He enters into the presence of God, He is offering Himself, not a bowl of blood, not even His own literal blood is the point, but it is the life that He presents before the Father. Because the imagery of blood sacrifice is, it's not really about death, it is about life. The life is in the blood. How do you get the life of this animal and in some kind of symbolism substitute that life for your life? Because your life is forfeit. You are a sinner. You have violated the covenant with God. You have the penalty of death upon you. And so in a symbolism, this life of this animal is being substituted for you. And that life is being carried into the presence of God on behalf of the nation. May we continue to live. Here is a life that is worthwhile, not a life that's been defiled by sin. Here's a life that you can look at. Well, how does animal blood work with that? You see, that's what the Hebrew writer is getting at. How is it that some dumb animal in his life has any real significance and meaning to God? And so that should have been a clue all along. There's something inherently defective about the system. And so what it pointed to, what it was telling us all along, is there has to be somebody's life that has some significant value that can be substituted for our life. The life of a sinless person. And so that's why this is not about human sacrifice. It isn't about, you know, just crassly, let's find some, you know, person and take their blood. And it is about Christ offering His life in our place. And His life is worthwhile because He was sinless. He was undefiled. And He is a human being, not an animal. And so that life has some value to God. And so as He is resurrected and enters into heaven itself, into the very presence of God, and He has the right to do that because He is sinless and holy, He then offers Himself before God to secure redemption for us. And so that's where the atonement, that's where the substitution takes place so that we can be forgiven of our sins. And so in the imagery of the Hebrew writer, with this atoning of the blood, the place of atonement is not where the animal is killed. In this case, it would not be the cross. You know, Jesus died on a cross. His blood was spilled on a cross. Well, if it's all about the blood, if it's all about the actual death itself, the place of atonement is the cross. But that's not what the Hebrew writer says. In the imagery again, the blood is taken in the presence of God, and there the life is offered before the Lord. And that's what Jesus has done. He has resurrected a living being, has entered into heaven itself, into the very presence of God, and offered himself, and secured therefore for us eternal redemption. And so his sacrifice is superior on every count. It is a spiritual sacrifice that takes place in heaven itself and is therefore eternal. It addresses the real problem and accomplishes that for us which we could not do for ourselves. And so he makes this analogy that the Old Covenant was about a lot of external rituals and things like that, and you were ceremonially defiled because you touch a dead body, and so you have to go through these rituals like the ashes of the red heifer. And, well, if that worked to ceremonially cleanse people, then how much more the sacrifice of Christ can really cleanse our consciences? Because that's what needs to be clean. Our consciences of sin, our guilt of sin, the knowledge that sin has really been addressed and removed. Because that's our real problem, is that we know that we are guilty of sin. We know that we bear the penalty of what we have done. We have done wrong. And how does that sense of guilt get removed? Well, God has provided a means by which it could be removed. But you can imagine a person saying, well, if I just kill X number of cows, then I'm not going to be guilty anymore. That just doesn't work, because the human mind, deep in the human heart, we know that it just doesn't make sense that somehow this animal is going to pay for my sin. But when God himself says, I will bear the penalty, I will satisfy the demands of justice. Yes, the requirement of sin is death, but I will pay that penalty and substitute my life for yours. And then we recognize it is about the grace of God, not some act of greatness on our part, not some good deed that we've done, not some moral action of our own, but it is the grace and the kindness and the mercy of God. But because it truly solves the problem of sin, again, it is permanent, it is eternal. And then in the next section, he turns his attention again to the new covenant. Now, we saw what the Hebrew writer had to say about this back in chapter 8. And so you might think, well, he's just repeating himself now. He's back to the new covenant, how there's got to be this new agreement between God and his people. But that's not really his point in bringing it up here. See, that says in verse 15, for this reason, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that, since a death has taken place for the redemption of the transgressions that were committed under the first covenant, those who have been called may receive the promise of the eternal inheritance. In other words, what he's talking about here is the fact that under that other covenant, people did not keep the covenant. They broke the covenant with God, and so they are guilty. What could they do about it if the covenant made no provision for truly removing their sin? If the only provision was, you know, make these animal sacrifices every year, over and over again, if that was all there was to it, then it didn't really solve the problem of the transgressions that were committed under that covenant. And that is particularly problematic because of what covenants are and what they mean. Now, verses 16 and 17 are two of the most difficult verses in all the New Testament to translate. And versions do lots of different things with them. There's basically three different approaches to these verses. And without getting into a detailed study of this at this time, I'll simply tell you which way I'm going to take this. Some think it's talking about making a last will and testament. And that, of course, until the person dies, they're testament isn't worth anything. And so, you know, if grandma leaves all of her possessions to, you know, a particular charity, well, the charity doesn't get her stuff until she dies. And when she does, then her wishes are, you know, enacted. And so I say, well, see, that's what's happening here. Jesus has given us his last will and testament, But, of course, he had to die in order for that last will and testament to take force. The problem with that is that there are plenty of examples of people who have last wills and testaments that can be implemented before they die. It does not require the death of a person. You can discharge your property. You can give all that stuff to charity before you die. You don't have to wait till you die to do that. There's no necessity for that. And that raises serious questions of whether that's what the Hebrew writer is really getting at. And so then others say, well, it is the fact that a covenant is ratified by a blood sacrifice. And although a lot of covenants are made that had blood sacrifices associated with them, not all of them did. You know, you could make an agreement with somebody without having to make a sacrifice to it. It's just a matter of making an oath, coming to an agreement with one another. Sacrifices don't need to be involved at all. That raises the question whether that's what he's talking about. It seems to me that what he has to say in verses 16 and 17 are in the context of what he's just said in verse 15. That in the case of a covenant that has been violated, what do you do? In such a case, since there is a covenant in force and it has been violated, then the death of the one who made the covenant must be borne. There is a penalty that must be paid for the breaking of this covenant. And so that is the point that's being made about the breaking of the first covenant, that a penalty has to be paid. A covenant is not any good. It has no force. It has no bearing whatsoever unless that penalty is paid. If you let the guy continue to live, there's no consequences to violating and breaking the covenant. It's not worth the paper it's written on. That seems to be what he's saying in verses 16 and 17. And so, therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. There was blood sacrifice offered up in association with this covenant that God made with Israel. And the point of all of that was to say, if you do not keep this covenant, the penalty of death of blood will fall upon you just as surely. And, of course, that agreement cut both ways. If God didn't keep his end of the bargain, then God should be chopped up in pieces and put to death. Now, again, that's just imagery because that's not going to happen. I don't know how you'd chop God in pieces and kill him anyway, but he's not going to violate his covenant. And this is the point of that peculiar story in Genesis chapter 14 where God makes an agreement with Abraham and he cuts up those carcasses of the animals and God passes through those carcasses to say by way of symbolism, if I do not keep my covenant, then may this be done to me. That's why people did that. They would say, you know, we say, cross my heart and hope to die. Well, may I be chopped up in pieces like the carcasses of these animals if I don't keep this sacred promise that I'm making in keeping this covenant. And God was willing to show his determination to keep his side of the bargain by offering that symbolism, that imagery to Abraham on that particular occasion. And so all of this about the blood that is associated with the first covenant was to impress upon the people, it is a solemn covenant, and if you break it, there is blood that is required, a life that is required. And so when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, this is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you. And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. And according to the law, almost, one might say, all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. And so, as he said back in verse 15, because there were transgressions under this covenant, because the covenant was violated and broken, what do you do? Well, Jesus has offered a sacrifice that is able to atone for the sins of that covenant. An atonement that was not possible by any other means. No animal sacrifice could have atoned for the blood of that covenant. And so he's saying we have a new covenant. He's already argued that we have a new covenant with God in chapter 8, but here's an aspect of that new covenant that he wants to emphasize, and that is that if this covenant is broken, there is true forgiveness of sins possible. because of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. And that's what leads him then to this final conclusion about this. In some ways, really, the first 18 verses of chapter 10 are the final conclusion to his argument. But this kind of wraps it up nicely. He said, therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. And because the first covenant was just a kind of a not a full covenant, and all of the trappings of it, like the sanctuary and the sacrifices, were not the true sanctuary, were not the true sacrifices. It was all symbolism. That's fine. But now the reality has come in Christ. We have a true sanctuary that we have access to in heaven. We have a true high priest, and we have a true offering. Because every priest has to have something to offer. And what is this priest going to offer? Well, he offers himself, because that is the only perfect sacrifice. For Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Nor was it that he would offer himself often, as the high priest enters the holy place year after year with blood that's not his own. Otherwise, he, Christ, would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world, but now once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. And it's interesting because here the Hebrew writer talks about the three appearances of Christ. In the past, he appeared to make atonement for our sin, and that was his crucifixion and resurrection. In the present, he is in heaven itself where he continues to make intercession for us. But then in the future, he's going to come back a second time to this earth. And this time, it's not going to be to atone for sin, but it will be to bring about judgment. And so just as all people, you know, die and then comes judgment, Jesus came and died. That was his first coming. And his second coming will be in regard to this judgment. And so you see how he develops this whole idea. Christ is in heaven itself, having offered up a perfect sacrifice once for all that atones permanently, eternally, for our sins. And so you think through that and you say, well, okay, so what? What does that really mean to me in practical terms? Well, you think about the significance of this. You know, this is really what chapter 10 was getting at. You know, if you really understand that Christ himself is in the presence of God for us, and that we have true redemption from sin, then what kind of person will I be? Will I be the kind of person that is all consumed about the earth? Or is my focus going to be on spiritual things and heaven? If I see all that Christ has done to accomplish the forgiveness of my sin, how then could I turn back to sin and continue in it? And I just think we need to be a more thoughtful people. We need to pause and reflect upon exactly how profound and significant it is of what Christ has accomplished for us. You know, it would have been amazing enough had we lived under the old covenant and we had been at Mount Sinai and we'd seen all the flashes of lightning and heard the thunderous voice of God and felt the ground shaking. And that had been really impressive. And we could have watched from a distance as the priests, kind of like busy bees around the hive, going in and out of the tabernacle and doing their thing. And the profound mystery and the significance of that one special day out of the year when the whole nation would fast and they'd watch the high priest come out and go in and do his thing. And oh man, how amazing that would be. And the Hebrew writer is saying, that's nothing. We live in a time where Christ has already done the real thing in heaven itself and offering himself as the permanent sacrifice for our sin. If you really understand that, are you really going to be all caught up about animals and blood sacrifice and these earthly rituals? A life that's given over to just an animal existence and day to day, that's all we can think about. What am I going to eat today? What am I going to wear? What kind of a car am I going to drive? What kind of job am I going to have? All of these things that, although many of those things are good in and of themselves and they're important parts of living a Christian life and how we do them, that's not what our life consists of. And we can become so distracted with these things and so caught up in the earthly, the mundane, that we lose sight of what it is we truly live for. We live for God. We live for His glory. We live to serve Him. We live to stay away from sin and to do what's right and to imitate the character of Christ. Because we know that we are better than that. We know that we have a destiny that is heaven itself and not this earth. And that destiny is not just a place, it is a state of glory. It is a state of sinlessness. It is a state of being with God in which we attain to the ultimate perfection of what is really important in this life, which is not self, but losing oneself in service to others. Because that's the very example that Christ has left for us. It's not about me, but it's about how I can live my life to glorify God and to do His will, and in that to serve my fellow man as best as I can. Utterly, selflessly, suffering, sacrificing, serving people that don't deserve it. That is what the new covenant is all about. It is what the way of Christ is about. It is the very meaning of the sacrifice that Jesus has accomplished. And if we just even have a fraction of an understanding of what that means, it will profoundly change the lives of service and sacrifice that we live. It will change the choices that we make each day and what we are preoccupied with and what we are focused on, what we think is important. But most of all, it reminds us of the character of God Himself, that He cares for us, He loves us, and He has done all of this for us. And in simple gratitude, and how can we not but return to Him in like manner, to want to do for Him, to love and to trust Him in return. If you will, take your songbook and turn to number 787 that Adam has selected for us. It is a song that focuses upon this very love and care that God has given to us. God cares for us in so many ways that we have to be thankful. But nowhere more supremely, nowhere more clearly than He gave Himself that we permanently might be forgiven of our sin and find a place in heaven with Him. And that is the true care that we need to come to know and to share with others. And that's why if there's some way we can be of help to you even today, if you know what it is you need to do to be closer to the Lord, to draw near to Him with a true heart and full assurance of faith because you're conscience has truly been cleansed of sin and your body's washed with pure water, to know what it is to draw near into the presence of God and to know that relationship with Him, it begins by having the conscience cleansed and being baptized into Christ. And if we can help you in doing that even this day, let us know what we can do for you while we stand and while we sing the song of encouragement.